What Sandy tells us about the future today, Tuesday, October 29th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A year after Sandy's wake-up call, we consider the storm's lessons from a climate change perspective and from the perspective of a Coney Island merchant who has reopened her pizzeria.
It fades away, the feeling, I think, that we're in danger, because this place has heart. The people here have heart.
Also today, a cartoonist raises the alarm about Syria.
You know, it just escalated and escalated and escalated, but it escalated so slowly that it seemed like it was always a crisis that was slowly getting worse and worse.
Plus, more than 500 varieties of licorice in Berlin.
We have actually 9 different double salted from Netherlands. You can find licorice from Scandinavia. It's smoked. There is licorice fudge from Sweden.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of 6 Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, Monday at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A year ago, Superstorm Sandy delivered a wake-up call to America. Suddenly, the steady rise in global sea levels took on immediate and domestic urgency. In a moment, we'll hear how Sandy still influences our thoughts on climate change. But first, for those who've had to rebuild, what a long year it's been. Last December, I met Antoinette Balzano outside of her family's flooded pizzeria in Coney Island, New York. Totino's was founded by Antoinette's grandfather from Naples, Italy, back in 1924. She and her brother and sister were determined to reopen.
I think we have to preserve what Grandpa came here to do, and we have to let that live on in the same fashion that he intended it to.
Well, Grandpa would be proud. Antoinette and her family did reopen in March. So, Antoinette Balzano, how's it feel to be back?
Oh, Marco, I have such mixed feelings today. I'm really just brought tears to my eyes. It's bittersweet because on my way here, I was so happy to come, realizing that you remembered us and you would come back and ask how we were doing. But I drove through Midland Beach on Staten Island. I live on Staten Island, and I just have those thoughts of those two children whose lives were swept away last year. So I'm really, my emotions are all screwed up. But as far as being back at Coney Island, I'm just thrilled. I'm thrilled, and the family is fine, and we're all very happy. We had a great summer, and we look forward to a good winter.
I got to say, you know, there are any number of pizza chains in this country, as you know. I'm not going to name names. And if they, with their stuffed crust, are as far genetically from the original Neapolitan pizza as you can get, Totino's, your family's place, is probably the closest. Is your grandfather's recipe still working post-Sandy?
You always make me laugh when you ask me those questions. You obviously don't know Cookie too well. She would never let anything change.
That's your sister.
I said that down to the nails in the wall are probably the same. Everything is the same. Everything is still working. And, you know, there are wonderful pizzerias in New York City, but nobody has what Grandpa has. And that is, he's the one who brought pizza to America. That's what he told us. He started making pizzas at Lombardi's, and he made Lombardi's become the first licensed pizzeria in America. So unless there's an older family that I don't know about, I think we're the oldest in the world by the same family, and we're very proud of that.
I gather you have put in a new tile floor to capture some of that old world feel. What has changed since Sandy? I mean, does Coney Island, does your neighborhood feel a little more cautious, perhaps?
You know what, Marco? I don't think so.
Really?
I think everybody has just been so busy to get back into business and get their homes back. It fades away, the feeling, I think, of that we're in danger, because this place has heart. The people here have heart. I was born here, and I can still feel the vibes when I come back. My blood pressure, I think, rises as I'm driving here from the Verrazano. So I don't think we feel in danger. And maybe we should. I don't know.
I mean, I know so much of getting this little slice of heaven back open was about paying respect to your grandfather, Anthony Perro. But what about the fact that you are on this little spit of land in Brooklyn? And if there's another storm like Sandy, you could be going through all this again. I mean, you've already dealt with a near crippling fire a few years ago.
With the Lord's blessings, I think that there are people watching us, and I'm sure Grandpa is, because, yeah, we've been through a lot. as long as we have the good health to continue, we're going to continue bringing the best pizzas in New York City to our customers, our very loyal customers.
So, Antoinette, are the hours still the same? What's the latest at night? I can grab the D train and get out to Coney Island for a pie.
Yes, you can. The hours are the same. We're open Wednesday through Sunday. I wanted to tell you, Marco, the thing that did change, it forced us to get a website. So we're coming a little bit into the 21st century and going on the computer. So that's a good thing.
What's a website?
As a matter of fact, I'm meeting with the fellow today. So we'll have a website, probably Totono's of Coney Island, something like that.
And what are the hours? How late are you open till?
Noon to 8 p.m., with the last seating being 7:30.
Right. So if you want a pie, you better be on the 6 p.m. In Midtown.
Otherwise, the mozzarella will be hanging out of your mouth as cookie escorts you out the door.
Antoinette Balzano co-owns Totono's Pizzeria in Coney Island with her brother and sister. The pizzeria was opened by her grandfather, Anthony Perro, in 1924. Antoinette, great to speak with you again. All the best.
Marco, thank you for remembering us and the people in Coney Island. God bless you.
So, in some ways, life seems to be more or less back to normal in the region that was slammed by Superstorm Sandy a year ago. But in other ways, things may never be the same. That's because Sandy was widely seen as a wake-up call to the clear and present dangers of climate change. In the days and months after the storm, politicians from New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg to President Obama used the storm to renew their calls for national action on climate change. A year later, the specific role of climate change in Sandy's $60 billion in damage is still being debated. But Associated Press science writer Seth Borenstein says, in general, climate science is clearer than ever.
Well, climate change was one of many factors in Sandy. And the one and most obvious factor that scientists point to is sea level rise. So much of the damage was water flooding. And you have, essentially, in New York, the sea levels are about a foot higher than they were a century earlier. And about two-thirds of that, they say, they can attribute directly to man-made global warming. With that extra foot of flooding, and two-thirds of which can be attributed to climate change, according to scientists, they're saying, when they looked at maps, that's 50,000 people whose homes were flooded. Wow. That would not have been flooded.
Are there still people out there who are saying, no, climate change had very little to do with Sandy?
There are deniers out there on that, just as like there are deniers on climate change, just like there are deniers that the Earth is round.
Okay. I mean, as much as we knew a year ago about climate change, climate science, as you know, is moving very fast. So what are the biggest things we know now about climate change, or at least are more certain about now than we were a year ago?
Well, actually, we're just more certain, period. That's one big thing. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just a month ago upgraded from the previous report their level of certainty. It's essentially they're saying they're 95% certain. And, well, to some people, 95% certain doesn't sound like an awful lot of certainty. In the world of science, you know, very few things, if any, are 100% certain. I talked to more than a dozen scientists to try to put 95% certainty into context. And they said it's about the same level of certainty as they have that cigarette smoking kills.
Right.
So that's one big thing. They're also more certain that we are seeing it in action now. This is not something in the future. We're seeing it in action now. In terms of the general sense among the scientists, there's just very little doubt among mainstream climate scientists. But you always have outliers, as you have in almost any scientific field.
So since last fall, I understand there's been a lot of research into whether the bizarre conditions that caused Sandy to combine with that other storm in the barrel under the coast, how it might be more likely as the world warms more.
Yes. The other factor in Sandy with climate change is one that's sort of the newest breaking science that's been going on for about a year and a half. And that's the changes in the jet stream, or the perceived changes in the jet stream. Their theory is that because of the reduced Arctic sea ice, we are seeing a jet stream that is slower, it is meandering more, dipping more. And that created, they say, the blocking systems that steered Sandy, in this case, directly in this due east to west turn that it made into New Jersey. That turn is a 1-in-700-year turn, according to studies that happened later. They're saying this was an unusual situation set up because of the changes in the jet stream. that even has been talked about with the big winter storms we saw last February, that those may have had a connection to the jet stream. Other scientists, mainstream scientists who've talked about climate change for a long time, don't buy this. So this is something that, if anything, it's gotten a little even muddier in the last few months.
Seth Borenstein, climate reporter with the Associated Press. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
This week marks the 75th anniversary of Orson Welles' legendary radio broadcast of The War of the Worlds. His story about a Martian invasion of a small New Jersey town caused mass panic in 1938 America, and it made international news a day after it aired here. But those headlines still didn't prevent fear and havoc in other parts of the world when copycat productions aired years later. Ibi Caputo, reporter here at WGBH, has our story.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
In retrospect, it was an unbelievable story. But at the time, across the U.S., people believed that a monster from Mars had crushed and burned nearly 7,000 people within minutes. Writer John Gosling is an expert in all things War of the Worlds. He says during the golden age of radio, Orson Welles captured a moment of vulnerability in the country, with the Great Depression still underway and the fear of Nazis growing.
The basic story is scary enough. You know, Martians are coming and they're going to destroy us and suck our blood and kill us and poison us. And, you know, it's a scary concept, but you can localize it still very, very well.
And Welles created a formula that could be easily replicated, which is exactly what happened again and again in Chile, Brazil, Portugal. Gosling calls it lightning in a bottle. In his book, Waging the War of the Worlds, he examines the history of the original broadcast and its many takeoffs, the deadliest of which happened in Quito, Ecuador on February 12, 1949.
Girl!
The popular music of Gonzalo Benitez started the Quito broadcast, and then, just as in the original, the music was interrupted by someone rushing to the mic with the news that Martians were invading, smothering neighboring cities with gas. Soon, other radio stations began repeating the story.
Something really quite horrible then happened.
Gosling says panic ensued. Priests were leading people in prayer on the streets. When the radio station realized what was happening, they issued on-air disclaimers, but that only made some people angry. About 300 people marched on the station, which was housed on the upper floor of the local newspaper.
They blocked all the exits. They hurled flaming torches into the basement, setting the presses on fire and all the chemicals down below on fire. They prevented the police from intervening. One of the actors was a broke character and pleaded on air for help from the authorities. But by all accounts, the authorities weren't there to help because the authorities, the police and military, had left town to go and fight the Martians.
At least six people died in the fire, and the broadcast tape was lost. There were other remakes of The War of the Worlds that caused minor panic, like the 1958 remake that aired in Portugal. The Lisbon War of the Worlds aired on a Catholic radio station. When people started getting worried, the police called the station and ordered the broadcast stopped. But the team of actors thought the police were joking. Who would be so gullible to fall for this again?
What then happened was that the military guys ended up in the station with guns, ordering them to stop. So they were literally stopped at gunpoint.
Portugal is a deeply religious country, where visions of the Virgin Mary are believed to have occurred. So Gosling says, coming as it did on a Catholic radio station, a tale of impending apocalypse wasn't so far-fetched. But could it happen again? Gosling thinks if we aren't careful, it could. In this golden age of social media, he says people often don't know what to believe. For The World, I'm Ibi Caputo.
Tonight on American Experience on PBS, much more on The War of the Worlds. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, Monday at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS. And from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The war in Syria has left the country's healthcare system crumbling. There are shortages of facilities, doctors, and medications. And now, the World Health Organization has confirmed 10 cases of polio in the country. It's the first outbreak there in 14 years, and it's raised alarms. And now the World Health Organization has set up an outbreak response, planning to immunize all children. Oliver Rosenbauer is a spokesman for the organization. He's in Geneva. Now, I gather this outbreak happened in the Syrian city of Deir al-Zour. How was it discovered?
Basically, there is as part of disease surveillance that has been set up over the past 2 years to using various sentinel sites and health centers around the country to look for diseases, in particular communicable diseases. So we received reports about 10 days ago of a cluster of 22 cases, which looked suspiciously as though they were polio. And so we've now received laboratory confirmation that indeed 10 of those cases are due to polio.
Right. So 10 cases. I don't know if that is a big outbreak. I mean, how serious would you assess this?
It's certainly very alarming and concerning. Polio is a devastating and very dangerous disease. And the problem is that it can spread very silently for a long time before it's detected. So we can't assume that it's only going to affect that particular area. So the outbreak response that's now being planned is much, much broader than just that particular region that's where the cases are confirmed.
Right. And what is that outbreak response?
Basically, because there is no cure for polio, the only thing that you can do is you can make sure that your children are vaccinated. Children under the age of 5 years are those who are most at risk. So that's what you have to do. You have to vaccinate as many of them as you can in order to stop this virus from spreading further and to stop more cases from occurring.
And remind us, Oliver, what happens when you get polio? And it's contagious, right?
It's a contagious disease caused by a virus, and it's a very devastating and painful disease. The primary symptom is basically paralysis, usually in the legs or arms. The paralysis is for life. Contrary to popular belief, there is no cure for polio, so that's why immunization is so important.
So with the war raging on, what are the hopes of getting this outbreak under control?
I think it's going to be very, very challenging, of course, to operate and run immunization campaigns in such settings. But we've seen from other areas with similar challenges that it can be done. This year, we're also having an outbreak in the Horn of Africa centered around Somalia. And the situation is not completely the same, of course, but they have similar challenges there. And they're running a very comprehensive outbreak response. I think we're seeing that cases are starting to decline very, very rapidly.
You and the WHO are certainly in the spotlight today. Did you ever imagine that in 2013 you'd be doing interviews about polio?
I think one thing that this very clearly shows is the need to eradicate this disease once and for all. There's three countries in the world that are still endemic, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And if you like, that's where the fire is. It's from there that you will always have spread of the virus into polio-free areas. It really underscores the importance of finishing eradication in those remaining endemic areas. Otherwise, you're always going to run the risk that polio comes back to polio-free areas anywhere.
Oliver Rosenbauer with the World Health Organization in Geneva. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The United Nations estimates that more than 2 million Syrians have fled their country. That is almost 10% of the population. If it keeps up, the UN says fully half of Syria's population could be displaced either internally or externally by the end of next year. It's a humanitarian disaster, a mass displacement of humanity on a scale not seen in decades. And from his perch in the San Francisco Bay Area, a cartoonist is trying to draw attention to it. Here's The World's Clark Boyd with a story.
Unlike the steady stream of Syrians being forced to flee their homes, the news about them seems to just trickle out.
In fact, what we are seeing is a deepening of the crisis, more and more people affected.
And in the end, the greatest victims, the people who suffer the most, are the Syrian people themselves who are being driven from their homes. And
desperate. If you could see the faces that I'm seeing now going past me, toddlers carrying bags, dragging bags along in the dirt as big as them, clutching bottles of water and bits of bread. Someone told me
that's exactly the image in the first panel of Andy Warner's latest piece for Slate. Warner's a cartoonist, a journalist whose medium is pen and ink. And his most recent work, called The Displaced, centers on the millions of Syrians who have been forced to leave.
This is one of the most devastating humanitarian crises right now. You know, it's worse than the refugee crisis from the Iraqi civil war.
Warner says that in the wake of the recent attention on Syria's chemical weapons, he wanted to remind readers that the refugee crisis continues.
Chemical weapons are an absolutely nightmare thing, and I think that a focus on them is very justified, but to the exclusion of the fact that by the end of next year, the UN estimates that fully half of Syria's population will be either internally or externally displaced, I think is really kind of losing the forest for the trees. Solving this diplomatic crisis that's happening surrounding the issue of the chemical weapons will not solve the Syrian conflict.
Warner's interest in using cartoons to tell stories from the region goes back to 2005. That's when he lived in neighboring Lebanon for a while. And as he puts it, you can't really learn about Lebanon without learning about Syria. Warner returned to Lebanon in 2011, when violence was just beginning to spread throughout Syria, but no one was yet calling it a civil war.
You know, it just escalated and escalated and escalated, but it escalated so slowly that it seemed like it was always a situation, a crisis that was slowly getting worse and worse, but never quite in the news cycle as much as it should have been, at least until this year. This year has really changed things, and you can see that in the refugee numbers, actually.
Warner's latest work focuses on those numbers. More than 500,000 Syrians now in Turkey, another 500,000 in Jordan, more than 750,000, he notes, in tiny Lebanon. And while much of the media attention has focused on refugee camps built to help displaced Syrians,
I think it's something like fully 3/4 of the population, the refugee population of Syrians throughout the region are actually not in refugee camps. A lot of the actual effect of this is on, you know, there's individual families taking people in. There's people living all throughout the region, not in these big concentrated areas.
And, as Warner notes in The Displaced, the UN's humanitarian appeal to the international community to tackle the Syrian refugee crisis has fallen short. The UN asked for more than $5 billion, but has to date received less than half of that. As for himself, Warner says he's looking for ways, and above all the means, to get back to the region. But for now, he continues to try to help people understand the Syrian conflict from a distance. For story ideas, he says he does tons of research and talks regularly with his contacts in the Middle East. He drew a comic recently that delved into the history of the Assad family, and one that looked at the 1949 coup in Syria, in which the CIA may have been involved. I asked him, why tackle stories like this with pen and ink?
It immediately draws you in. I think that having that engagement with the reader can make it that much more powerful, make it stick, make people want to show it to other people.
To put a human face, in other words, on the numbers. As Warner writes at the end of The Displaced, the Syrian refugees are not just a mass of humanity. These are individual people. They've lost homes. They have lost loved ones. They now live in poverty and danger. And Warner emphasizes, the war grinds on. For The World, I'm Clark Boyd.
You can see a panel from Andy Warner's The Displaced at PRI.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, taking issue with Turkey's prime minister on big infrastructure projects.
When archaeological finds were found in Yenikapı, amazing treasures from the 4th century, it was Tayyip Erdogan who said that people are delaying progress for the sake of a few pots and shards.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of 6 Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, Monday at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. You remember that dance tune from the 80s with the chorus, "I got this feeling somebody's watching me"? Not just a feeling these days. The entire watching business itself is being closely watched, from the National Security Agency to journalists who watch or listen in ways they're not supposed to. In a few minutes, we'll hear about the latest twist in Britain's phone hacking scandal. First, though, we keep the spotlight on the NSA. Embarrassing revelations about the agency snooping on friendly world leaders have caused outrage abroad and put President Obama on the defensive. Tim Weiner is the author of the book Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. He formerly covered the intelligence gathering beat for the New York Times. And Weiner says we've seen this movie before in the 1970s.
After Watergate, the Senate held hearings in which we learned that the NSA had been spying on Americans. Those Americans included Martin Luther King and several United States senators, as well as political opponents of Presidents Johnson and President Nixon. Now, what we got after those very painful public hearings was a set of laws and procedures. We got the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is supposed to oversee the NSA and grant it authority to conduct wiretapping and eavesdropping operations. The technology to do this has now exceeded the policy to control it. And the freedom that Bush gave the NSA with secret orders enforced by a secret court and guided by secret laws have obviously grown to the point where they're not only potentially dangerous to democracy in terms of gathering information on Americans, but ridiculous, like listening in on Chancellor Merkel of Germany. And when people start laughing at you in the context of foreign policy and politics, that's dangerous.
I mean, there have been a number of people in the past few days who've been talking about a new congressional committee a la the Church Commission aimed at opening up the U.S. Secret Services and what they do. It almost sounds like you're saying that the system is so entrenched that a proper and wholly honest self-examination may not even be possible at this point.
Well, the Senate Intelligence Committee in particular would have to grow a spine for that to happen. It could happen. Stranger things have happened. But it would be at a cost. And the cost would be that this administration, President Obama, and this Congress would have to question the leaders of American intelligence about what they have done in our name in an open session. And what they have done is, in their view, so secret and so imperative to the national security of the United States that you cannot discuss it in an open democracy. And there is the tug of war.
Tim, what is the mood in this whole circle that you cover these days? I mean, the FBI, CIA, NSA, what are your sources telling you? What kind of frame of mind are they in?
Well, the FBI has new leadership. There's constant churning leadership at the NSA. And the CIA is feeling pretty good about itself, frankly, in terms of its attack on foreign terrorist groups. I think that the real problem here lies in outmoded and outdated command and control systems for electronic eavesdropping. The technology to do this has outstripped the policy to control it, and the policy and the laws have to get back in line. To go back to the beginnings of the NSA, it never had a charter, and it has now gone beyond, I think, the rule of common sense, much less the laws of the United States, in its pursuit of secret information. I mean, information is power. Secret information, which is a definition of intelligence, is power squared. And secret information that only you can deliver to the president, that is power cubed.
All right, Tim, thank you so much. We'll leave it there.
Anytime.
Tim Weiner, author of the book Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. The British government has also been embarrassed recently by revelations of its spying activities. But this week, the focus in Britain is once again on phone hacking by the press. Earlier this year, a number of newspapers were found to have illegally hacked into the voicemails of celebrities and crime victims without their knowledge. Jury selection is now underway in the trial of two former editors whose newspapers used hacking in their reporting. The trial has triggered a vigorous debate on whether Britain needs some new press regulations and whether politicians can be trusted to police the press. Matthew Paris is a columnist for The Times of London.
There is a potential conflict between what we call privacy or privacy on the one hand and what we call freedom of information on the other. And one man's invasion of privacy is another man's curtailment of freedom of information. And I suppose no one feels very sentimental about the privacy of communications within government, for instance, or about the information held by the CIA. On the other hand, when the press appear to be delving into the private lives of completely innocent citizens who are not politicians, people instinctively go onto the side of those individuals who may have had their deceased daughter's mobile phone messages hacked. Mm.
How far would you go to supporting some state mechanism to regulate the press in the UK?
I would go no way at all. Mm. I even feel that my own newspaper, News International, Rupert Murdoch's outfit, have gone almost too far in the compromise. I hate the idea that any newspaper or magazine, big or small, should be have to go to an organisation that is in position to deem what is and what is not in the public interest. On the whole, I think that the only criterion is truth, and that if something is true, it may be inappropriate, it may be stupid, it may be an unwelcome interference into somebody's private life, but if it's true and if it's legal, then publish it.
Matthew Paris, I suspect you've given this next question a fair amount of thought. How do you think the Edward Snowden revelations have actually affected the debate on phone hacking?
The idea that the state might be doing to us what some of our newspapers have been doing to private citizens has horrified people, and to that extent, I suppose, increased the general sense of public allergy to snooping or eavesdropping of any kind. However, the logical links between what's happening with Snowden and what we want to insist on in terms of press freedom are not altogether clear and are really quite inconsistent.
Do you think you've ever been hacked into or had your private files or life investigated without your knowledge?
I don't know if I've ever been hacked into in electronically. I do know that when I was first a member of parliament and a gay MP, I received a letter from a young man in Northern Ireland who said that he was a young male model looking for somewhere to live in London because he wanted to make his way in the world. And did I know anybody who could offer him a room? And I've always thought that that was such an unlikely thing to come out of the blue to a member of parliament from an individual who couldn't possibly have taken the view that he'd be likely to get a very helpful response from most of them, that I've always thought it quite likely that a newspaper had decided to do a private investigation into me. How would I have felt if they had? Well, if, as a Member of Parliament, I had replied to a young male model and said that he could come and stay in my flat, and if he did, and if he was then taking notes or recording things, and if I'd behaved inappropriately, I've got to conclude that it would just have served me right.
Matthew Paris, a columnist with the Times of London, thanks very much.
Thanks.
I thought the Channel was a big deal. It is, but it's not linking two continents the way the Iron Silk Road is. Today, the world's first underwater rail link between two continents opened for business. Turkey unveiled its new 8-mile-long tunnel linking Europe and Asia via the Bosphorus Strait. Sibel Bozduan is a Turkish-American architect. So there are bridges across the Bosphorus, right? But a tunnel just seems really important. So what is it going to do that bridges have not done so far for the whole geography and society around the Bosphorus and Istanbul?
Well, the shift towards rail systems from cars and buses is a very important accomplishment that has already started with the subway and the light surface rail. So the tunnel will complete that. So to carry, when it comes to maximum capacity, according to their estimates, when it carries 1.5 million people per day, you know, that is a major help to Istanbul's traffic in ways that the cars across the bridges are not. But the larger question about bringing cultures together, that I believe is a bit more tricky. At the moment, we don't know many technical details about how that will actually be done. If it is meant to enhance trade between Europe and Asia, what will be the logistics of that transit traffic of goods? In other words, will actual freight trains be running through the tunnels? How will Istanbul's commuter traffic will overlap with transit traffic of this dreamed of new Silk Road? I really don't know at the moment.
What about just kind of cross-fertilization of cultures? I mean, that when you have greater efficiencies between people, they start exchanging ideas.
Yes, but I also think that there is a difference between the idea of an economic and a geopolitical bridge and the idea of a cultural bridge on the other. I mean, the first one is more pragmatic and instrumental. The other has to do more with shared visions of life. Trains and tunnels may suffice with, say, connecting with China and doing business. But if you are talking, let's say, about a truly connecting with Europe, it needs more than rail infrastructure. It needs a democratic culture and openness to differences. And as you know, in a lot of these areas, the distance between Europe and Turkey has been increasing rather than decreasing lately.
I hear some Turks are also angry that $2.8 billion has been spent on this tunnel. What are Turks exactly upset about?
More than the cost, I think the broader criticism is this government's, and in fact, personally, the prime minister's political and rhetorical use of infrastructural mega projects. You know, for them, roads, tunnels, and bridges are unquestionable instruments of progress. Any criticism or concern regarding, for example, historical heritage, environmental or social justice, or in this case, even safety, as you know, questions of safety were raised, all of these are dismissed as subversive. Erdogan loves this image of the prime minister in a hard hat. You know, he was the one during the excavations when archaeological finds were found in Yenikapı. These were amazing treasures of Emperor Theodosius from the 4th century, the sunken port. It was Tayyip Erdogan who said that people are delaying progress for the sake of a few pots and shards. So continents are crossed, bigger, deeper, taller structures are built, and we are all expected to be grateful. Never mind the lack of transparency, lack of oversight. So this government, I would say, is unable to understand why many people are not bending over in gratitude.
Are you at least feeling a little bit of pride today?
Yes, I can say that as an engineering feat, first intercontinental tunnel, the deepest one under the water, 60 meters under the sea level. But I don't think pride can be isolated from all the concerns that come with it because, you know, people demand participation, transparency, accountability. So those cannot be put aside just to applaud this important engineering feat, I think.
Architect and architectural historian Sibel Bozdoğan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
From a tunnel below the waves of the Bosphorus to above water now, and a quick story that caught our ear and eye today. It's about Britain's merchant navy using the music of Britney Spears to scare off Somali pirates. Sounds like a headline from The Onion, right? But it's not. According to reports in the British press, apparently security officers on British ships navigating pirate-infested waters off the coast of Africa have succeeded in keeping the bad guys at bay by playing such classics as Oops, I Did It Again and Baby One More Time. One officer told the tabloid The Mirror that the songs were chosen because the security team, quote, thought the pirates would hate them most. These guys can't stand Western culture or music making Britney's hits perfect, end quote. Western ships traveling routes around the Horn of Africa are in constant danger from pirates boarding and kidnapping crews for multi-million dollar ransoms. But it seems the thugs will actually flee from a couple of past-their-prime Western pop songs. Never thought this music would have such a long tail. If you're wondering about using more current hits to fend off pirates, a security expert quoted by The Mirror had this warning, "I'd imagine using Justin Bieber would be against the Geneva Convention." Well, this may scare off Somali pirates, but hopefully you'll stay right where you are. We're back after a quick break here on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom, in theaters now.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A bit of a sweet diversion now from the news. You'll find candy in almost every culture, and there are millions of shops keeping customers supplied. But in wandering the streets of Berlin, reporter Sandy Hausman came across one shop that specializes in a pretty surprising product, at least for Germany.
16 years ago, Ilse Berger was looking for a new career. And she found it in her passion for a particular candy.
I grew up near the border to the Netherlands. And the Netherlands, they know licorice.
Berger is now an aficionado too, but not everyone in Germany shares her enthusiasm. And in some neighboring nations, it's next to impossible to find licorice.
There is a black area around Switzerland and Austria. They hate it. There it is named Bärendreck.
Bärendreck means bear poop. And during a part of the manufacturing process, that's pretty much what licorice looks like. Undeterred, Berger decided to spread her love for the candy by selling it. She started by giving tastes at farmers' markets and eventually opened a tiny licorice shop called cadeau, a word borrowed from the French for gift. Her husband, Frank Büttner, joined the enterprise, although he admits he's not keen on the taste.
I love my wife, and I love marzipan. And also potato chips.
Oh, yeah, perhaps. Hello.
Their store is in Grefekiez, a charming old neighborhood that survived the war. Inside, there are hundreds of apothecary jars packed with a bewildering variety of colors and shapes, large and small, sweet and salty.
We have actually 9 different double-salted from Neverland. You can find licorice from Scandinavia. It's smoked. We have a wide range of hard candies to licorice. Inside the powder of licorice or the powder of salt, there is a candy, it's like fudge, we say for it, licorice fudge, it's from Sweden.
Büttner figures there are more than 500 kinds on sale. For those with special dietary needs, they're sugar-free, gluten-free, kosher. It's Monday and cadeau is normally closed, but Ilse unlocks the door for a customer in need of his licorice fix. As she weighs his order, the man browses shelves of colorful candy tins, bottles of licorice liqueur, bags of licorice coffee, and jars of licorice jam, then collects his purchase in a specially folded paper cone. He leaves, and Ilse locks the door again, but another customer arrives, a little boy, peering through the window, hoping for some black licorice pipes.
So he's crying now, so you can't.
She opens the door again to admit the child and his mother, Cornelia, a psychologist who lives in the neighborhood. She says licorice is a family favorite.
My sister likes, my husband likes, so I'm not an addict. So.
But you're here often buying presents?
Yes, yes, I have to. For my husband, when I have some crucial issues to to negotiate.
The antique cash register has rung up enough sales in the past 16 years to support Cadeau's owners, and their success has inspired other specialty shops to open nearby. They include an Italian ice emporium that features, among other things, ice cream made with pure licorice powder from Cadeau. For The World, I'm Sandy Hausman, Berlin.
Ilse Berger kind of stumbled into her current licorice career. Brooklyn-based pianist Richard Bennett sort of stumbled into ragas, a system that underpins Indian classical music. Bennett traveled to India a few years ago to accompany his wife, a singer, who wanted to study with an Indian vocalist. Soon, he was jamming with the Indian musicians himself. Next month, Bennett's fourth album of raga-infused piano music is due out. Reporter Bruce Wallace spoke with Bennett about the album and about the role Hurricane Sandy, which flooded his neighborhood a year ago, played in the album's creation.
It turns out that sometimes the simpler ragas are harder to play because, says Richard Bennett, they can end up sounding kind of like nursery rhymes.
I once went to a raga concert, and I swear whatever raga the guy was playing, it sounded like somebody playing The Bear Went Over the Mountain for an hour. So you have to watch for these associations of the notes. Of course, I don't think he knew The Bear Went Over the Mountain.
When he takes up a simpler raga, an Indian scale, plus guidance on using the scale, Bennett searches for the moodier aspects that lie under the nursery rhymey surface. He showing me a raga called Hansa Dwani. The name means Song of Swans. He'd known about the raga for a while, but was inspired to write a song using it by an experience he had a few days after Hurricane Sandy ravaged New York and New Jersey. He was walking in a bird sanctuary on the water on the outskirts of New York City. The sanctuary had been damaged by the storm.
Around a quarter mile in, you couldn't walk any further because the water had gone over the land and it had created this big moat. And I get up to the edge of the moat, and all of a sudden this enormous swan comes climbing out and stares right at me. And I'd already been thinking about Hansa Dwani and recording, and I was thought, well, this is a sign of nature.
His exploration of the raga turned into a four-piece suite on his new album. Bennett's apartment, only a few blocks from the East River, was remarkably unaffected by Sandy. His tabla player, who lives nearby, was not as lucky. He didn't have power for 6 weeks. He spent much of the time crashing on Bennett's floor.
I have a couch, but he prefers floors, and we actually recorded quite a lot of the music in my apartment. He would wake up, he'd set up, and then we would start playing, so out of his hardship came the music.
Bennett says those weeks after Sandy were actually a good moment to focus more fully on music. New York City was struggling to recover, and a lot of music venues were closed. Musicians would gather and record at his apartment.
We knew we had all day. There was no place to go. So when you know you have all day, the pressure of having to get music done in a certain time is off.
His adventures in Indian music, which now span 8 years and 4 albums, have focused him too, he says, making him more fully appreciate the potential of individual notes. Ragas can play out over a long time, musicians milking each note before moving on to the next.
If you've ever gone to a club and you've seen people dancing to the same beat for half an hour and then they just change one beat of the drum and everybody goes nuts, it's the same idea as the raga idea. It's the value of a note.
The value of a note and of fleeting moments. Lessons he learned in India and in a piece of New York reshaped by Hurricane Sandy. For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace, Brooklyn, New York.
We end our show today with pianist Richard Bennett. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.